Good afternoon. My name is Stephen Dawes, number 13193 of the law firm of Blake Kelly and Dawes on behalf of Shelter Mutual Insurance Company. The relief we're requesting in this case is several fold. First, the trial court reformed an insurance policy on a blazer. And throughout the course of this, I may refer to this as the Unit 10 or the blazer policy. The court reformed it because the court determined that erroneously that the instructions and information given by Shelter's agent Stephen Dazzler didn't meet the standards of Allstate versus Parkrig. That decision was erroneous not only because the evidence was unequivocally and overwhelming that Mr. Dazzler's advice to Noble Shaw, and when I say Noble Shaw, I'm referring to the father, as opposed to Ryan, who's the actual plaintiff, that Mr. Dazzler's explanation to Mr. Shaw met all the standards of the Parkrig test. In addition, Shelter had obtained on two different occasions rejection of uninsured, underinsured motorist benefits signed by Noble Shaw on that particular unit.
Well, let me ask you, if I can, Mr. Dawes, on the first issue, there is no question Mr. Dazzler gave his testimony and testified about his habit of practice. But the court here made extensive findings and rejected that. I found made a credibility finding that found Mr. Shaw's, Noble Shaw's testimony more credible on the point than Mr. Bassler's. How do we overcome that based on the standard of review?
Because the court misunderstood and misapprehended Mr. Bassler's testimony first, and second, because I'm asking that you find as a matter of law the UMUIM rejection forms meet the standard under the statute.
Well, let me ask you about that. On the rejection form, I'm now forgetting his name, Mr. Heller, I think it was, they testified himself, this is your witness, that if the rejection forms are signed based on misinformation, they would be invalid. And the court credited that. I mean, what do we do with that?
Because there isn't misinformation on the form. I guess anybody would say if there's misinformation on a form, it shouldn't be disregarded, but what's the misinformation on the form?
But no, what I understood that Mr. Heller's testimony would be was if Mr. Shaw was misadvised about UIM coverage, that if you buy on one, you don't need it on the blazer if you've got the other two, which is what Mr. Shaw's testimony was. Mr. Heller said if he was so advised that was wrong, and based on that, the rejection form would be invalid. That's your own witness.
Well, the problem here is that that's not what Mr. Bassler said, and I think the court missed it. Okay, it missed it in this regard. First of all, you have to remember that Noble Shaw signed two rejection forms on two different occasions. He purchased uninsured motorist property damage coverage. As Mr. Bassler explained, that's a rare type of coverage. Few people buy that. What it evidences is that Mr. Shaw understood the difference between bodily injury uninsured motorist coverage and property damage motorist coverage. And there's this misunderstanding that has been conveyed through the course of this, and that is that somehow Mr. Bassler misinformed him that if he didn't have uninsured motorist coverage on the Blazer, they would have still the same coverage on the other two vehicles. And that's not what he testified to.
That's not what Mr. Bassler testified.
That's right.
Okay, but Mr. Shaw did. I mean, Mr. Shaw said that's what he told me, and he said that's what Ms. Gutierrez told me, and Ms. Gutierrez's supervisor said that's what he instructed Ms. Gutierrez to say.
Ms. Gutierrez, first of all, was a secretary. It is a red herring and misstatement to conclude that she was a Shelter agent because she was not. And the scheme in this case was to take her deposition of a secretary and say, who didn't understand the law, and say that this must have been what was advised. That's not true. The last person that Mr. Shaw talked to was Steve Bassler about his coverage when they raised the coverages in September, effective September 11, 2007. So to say that somehow Ms. Gutierrez misinformed is not what the evidence was. Number two, I understand the judge said, well, Mr. Shaw understood this and that must be the fact, but the fact is that it was undisputed, as according to Mr. Bassler, so what he said. That was undisputed. What was disputed by Mr. Shaw was that he didn't understand that under the De Herrera case, if there's no coverage on the Blazer, resident relatives and insureds would be covered, but non-resident relatives, passengers wouldn't. And Mr. Basil made it unequivocally clear that he didn't say who would be covered, he said who would be covered. And Mr. Shaw didn't refute that. He just made general statements about, oh, well, I didn't understand that if I didn't have the UM coverage on the Blazer, then I wouldn't have coverage for a non-resident passenger who was injured in that Blazer. But we know that that can't be accurate because he himself not only signed the rejection forms, but he elected to buy UM property damage coverage on that only. Why? Because that was his favorite vehicle that he had restored. The second thing is that this rejection form, I think, as a matter of law, should be found to meet the elements of Parfrey. I mean, what does somebody have to do to get a rejection form? On two different occasions, Mr. Shaw signed the fact that he didn't want UM and UIM coverage on that Blazer. The other aspect of this is
Mr. Dodds, may I ask you a question on the rejection letters? If Mr. Shaw was relying on Shelter's representations that he was already covered on all three policies, and then he went ahead and signed the rejection letters based on that reliance, how does that affect your analysis?
Because there was no evidence that he wasn't, that somebody told him that he wasn't or wouldn't be or would be covered differently from what Mr. Basler said. In other words, what Mr. Basler testified to was, look, I can't remember every single conversation I had with hundreds and hundreds of people, and there isn't an agent in this free world that would remember that. It's no different than a police officer who says 500 automobile accidents, and he comes to the trial, you remember that conversation? Probably not every word of it, but on this occasion, he knows for sure that he advised Mr. Shaw of that coverage and what would be covered when he rejected the UM on the Blazer, because the coverage on the other two vehicles insures both him and resident relatives. So it's not conceivable that Mr. Shaw could have understood anything different based upon A, his signing of the rejection forms, B, the property damage coverage he did buy on uninsured motorists when he didn't want uninsured motorist bodily injury coverage, and C, the explanation which Mr. Basler gives, which I contend, as a matter of law, meets all the elements of the Parfrey test. I'm not sure if that answered your question.
It does. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The other aspect of this is that the court reforms the policy and then says that Shelter unreasonably delayed in paying the $50,000 on the Blazer policy. Well, if the policy had just been reformed, how could Shelter have unreasonably delayed on that? The argument may be made, well, they should have known that there was a should be coverage on the Blazer. How would they know that, A, in light of what Mr. Basler said, and B, in light of two separate rejection forms? I think it was error for the court, if it's going to reform the policy, to say that Shelter unreasonably delayed under the unreasonable delay statute, which, as you know, is 10-3-1115 and 1116. How could they have unreasonably delayed since that order didn't come out until the judgment in this case?
Do we have any case law that says that the time for when you reform is later rather than when the supposed violation took place?
Well, we cited the Brennan, I think it's Brennan versus the Lyons case in a brief, and that's a no-fault PIP case having to do with enhanced no-fault PIP, or what they call APIP, personal injury protection benefits. And that's what the court said in that case. And I think they were citing to an earlier one as well. And I read it this morning. I may be wrong, it might be the Stark case, but I think that's what the rule is in this.
Is it your position that Brennan, I take it your view is that the PIP cases would apply equally, and even though this is a UIM case, the same analysis would apply?
In that regard, yes.
Is it your position that Brennan holds as a matter of law that the reformation date has, that there can't be unreasonable delay until the reformation, or does it depend on the facts?
In that case, as I recall, the Court of Appeals said that it was within the court's discretion based upon the facts of that particular case.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get to.
Right.
I mean, as I read it, Brennan seems to, and I'm not asking you to agree, I'm just asking to make sure I'm reading the case right. The case seems to suggest that if the insurer should reasonably have anticipated that they would have to have cover, then you could relate the reformation back, the date. It says some language like, you know, should not necessarily have anticipated. In Brennan, the court said, on these facts, the statute was really unclear, and the insurer there shouldn't have anticipated. Here, so the question, I guess, for us is here whether Shelter should reasonably have anticipated being responsible. Is that the correct analysis?
There isn't an agent in this country that would conclude, or an adjuster in this country that would conclude, that they should reform their policy in the light of two separate rejection forms signed by their insurer.
Right, except the problem, again, and not to be pushing on the same point, the trial judge rejected them. The trial judge made a finding that Shelter should have reasonably anticipated that it was going to owe that money as of January 20th, I think it was, in 2010. What do we do with that finding?
I think it was clearly erroneous.
Okay.
Thank you. Addition, so was the finding of awarding prejudgment, and I think, in fact, there's an error of law to award prejudgment interest on the Blazer policy because of the USAA versus Parker case. I see that my yellow light is on. I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
You may. Thank you, Mr. Dodson. Mr. Calhoun.
May it please the court, Stephen Kaufman appearing on behalf of the plaintiff, Mr. Shaw, 10564, my bar number. For purposes of Shelter's argument, it doesn't matter that Agent Basler says he said doesn't so. What matters is that there's some evidence in the record to support the trial court's findings. The plaintiff testified that Agent Basler told him he would have the same coverage even if he rejected coverage on the Blazer. That's sufficient. There doesn't need to be anything else. The trial court can make a decision on who to believe and what evidence to suggest. But even Mr. Shaw testified that Agent Basler told him, if you have it on one, you have it on all. Agent Basler also testified that that's what he told Mr. Shaw. If you have it on one, you have it on all. So that in itself supports the trial court's findings. So there's no ground to reverse because there's evidence in the record to support the trial court. In terms of when the policy can be reformed, it is discretionary, and different courts have reformed it at different points in time, from issuance to the date of the accident to the date of the judgment. Brennan specifically pointed out that it was discretionary, and that was because the insurer didn't really have adequate notice by case law that the policy could be reformed. But there was adequate notice here, beginning back, I think, in 1992 with the Parfrey decision. And then Thompson came out and said he reformed the policy. And then even Brennan itself stands as grounds to show that the policy will be reformed if you provide inadequate information. So,
can I interrupt you, Mr. Calvin,
sure.
On this point? Let me ask you, and I'll tell you, this issue concerns me. It's probably one of your arguments that concerns me the most. Well, I understand what the law is. I understand there's discretion. But what are the facts that support an argument here that Shelter should reasonably have anticipated not only that, you know, the court coverage might be required here, but that reformation would have happened as of that January 20th date? I guess there's some evidence that they thought it was that would support an argument as of January 20th or whatever it was. They knew they owed at least 100. I understand those facts. But what facts would have led them to understand that the court would reform and reform as of that date? That, I mean, I think to get unreasonable denial or delay, there have to be evidence that Shelter expected that to happen or should reasonably have anticipated a reformation as of that date. Particularly given that it's discretionary, what evidence would support that?
Well, you know, the fact is, basically, the trial court is reforming at least as of the date of the accident, okay? Because otherwise, she couldn't have awarded $50,000 of UIM coverage on the Blazer and required Shelter to pay that. So we know it's not January 20th, that she's reforming the policy as of. She's reforming it at least as of the day of the accident, or perhaps, I mean, she doesn't really talk about it, or perhaps as of the day of the issuance. And reforming it, of it as of the day of the accident is certainly proper in view of the case law that made it clear to insurance companies that when you are inadequately advised and insured, you are going to have the policy reformed. Now, the
Jennifer, Cardenas, excuse me, I just want to make sure which case law we're talking about. Cardenas, Thompson, those cases?
Well, Thompson I'm familiar with, Parfley I'm familiar with, Brennan itself, because, you know, only because they weren't, they didn't anticipate because of the case law. So Brennan itself stands for grounds of reformation as of the date of the accident. The January 20th date is the date that stands out as to when Shelter would have had the information, knowing that they should have paid the undisputed benefits and so on. So in this regard, to me, the real issues, the real meat to chew on for purposes of this appeal can be found in the cross appeal. And in that regard, it's plaintiff's position that all policies should have been reformed, provide for at least $100,000 in UM/UIM coverage, or coverage up to the amount of the plaintiff's damages. Let's first look at this issue with respect to the Blazer policy. Mr. Shaw, the plaintiff's father, was advised about UM/UIM coverage under the pre-amendment statute. He rejected that coverage, but yet the court reformed the policy to provide for $50,000 of UIM coverage because he had been adequately informed. Under the pre-amendment policy, there was a $100,000 cap on the amount of UM/UIM coverage that could be purchased. So therefore, it's deemed to be in the law that that's what Mr. Shaw would have selected had he been adequately informed.
Well, let me ding on you the same way I guess I dinged on Mr. Dawes. It strikes me that much of this argument, perhaps with the exception of the setup issue, you're arguing against facts that the court found against your client. The issue of he didn't know the difference between per occurrence and per person and per accident. The court found against your client on that, made a credibility determination in favor of Shelter. So I want you to get to the set-off issue, but much of the argument you have in your brief seemed to be factual, and the court made factual findings against you.
Well, first of all, let's just deal with the Blazer policy.
Okay,
because the court found that he had been inadequately informed. So the issue is, did the court have a choice to reform the policy to $50,000, or was it required as a matter of law to reform the policy to $100,000? It's plaintiff's position that it is required to reform it to $100,000, and the Davis versus Guide 1 decision, the Court of Appeals decision, held that in the PIP context when the plaintiff had not been adequately informed about his option to purchase enhanced PIP coverage, and so the policy was reformed to provide for that coverage in accord with the statutory maximum.
And, you know, that case, as I recall it, and correct me, said that you could put in the policy a $200,000 limit, and that's what the court didn't do, the trial court in Davis, and the Court of Appeals, or Division of the Court of Appeals, said they had a $200,000 limit. I'm going to do that because that's what the statute said, right?
Right, that there could be a $200,000 limit, and here, under the pre-amendment statute, when the rejection and the inadequate advisement took place, there was a $100,000 cap. And so that's why the policy needed to be reformed to $100,000.
Could you explain why you think the pre-amendment statute applies as opposed to the amendment statute?
A couple of reasons. The pre-amendment statute applies because amendments to a statute are applied prospectively unless there's a clear legislative intent to the contrary, to apply them retroactively. There's nothing in the amendments here to indicate that the legislature intended to excuse in an adequate advisement under the old statute, nor a public policy would also preclude a reading of that intent into the amendments in order to encourage insurers to give complete and accurate information at the time of the advisement. You also have to look at, and this is important, the event or transaction to which the statute is being applied to. It is not the reissuance of the policy after the amendment went into effect, but it's rather the advisements that took place under the pre-amended statute, because it's based on those advisements that Mr. Shaw makes his determination as to whether to have or reject UM or UIM coverage, and he makes his determination based on those advisements as to the amount of the limits to select. Also, it's based on the inadequacy of those advisements that gives rise to the claim for reformation. So for those reasons, it's our position that the pre-amendment statute applies. But here's the point. If the pre-amendment statute doesn't apply and the post-amendment statute applies, well, then there's no limitation as to amount. That was the Thompson versus Budget Rent-A-Car decision. Basically, in that case, the insured had not been properly informed about PIP benefits, and the maximums wouldn't have been in the policy. And so therefore, the Court of Appeals reformed the policy to provide for PIP coverage without limitation as to amount, except up to the amount of plaintiff's damages. So that's why, you know, that would be the alternative.
Although that case, the statute said without dollar limitations, right?
Pardon?
In Thompson, the statute at issue said without dollar limitations. So again, the court was just saying, or the division just saying, without dollar limitations, because that's what the statute says.
Well, no, because, I mean, the Guy Williams, the Davis versus Guy Williams, dealing with the same PIP statute, yet they reformed it in accord with the statutory maximums because they concluded that that would have been in that particular policy. Thompson concluded it wouldn't have been in that policy. So the point of it is, if you take the position that plaintiff, you know, that there would have been a $100,000 cap, well, then it's reformed to $100,000. But on the other hand, there's more than $400,000 in this case as far as damages that were stipulated to. So if you reform it the other way, if the post-amendment statute applies, then it's reformed. Either way, it's reformed to provide for UIM benefits. But if the post-amendment statute applies, there's no limitation as to amount.
Well, would, and forgive me if I remember, so doesn't the post-amendment statute say you have to make it available up to the amount of bodily injury coverage, which would be the 50 here? Am I misremembering? Correct me if I got it wrong. I thought in the post-amendment world, that's what has to be offered, that you could, the insurer can take UL or UIM coverage up to the amount of bodily injury. He had 50 in bodily injury, therefore he would get 50 in UIM. I think that's what the trial court held here.
Well, I think you have to go by what the case law says. The case law says if you don't adequately inform the insured, he has the coverage without limitation as to amount. Because if he had been adequately informed, you don't know what amount of liability limits, for example, he would have selected so that he could have higher UM/UIM limits. And therefore, there would be no cap for that reason. You can't give a non-complying insurer the benefit of speculation. In terms of the pickup and Jeep policies, those too must be reformed. And Your Honor makes the point about the setup. There's no dispute here that Mr. Shaw was not told about the set-off. And so there being no dispute that he wasn't told about the set-off, well then, if the pre-amendment statute applies, the pickup and the Jeep policies have to be reformed.
What law says, and I know you made this argument with all respect, in a pretty cursory way in the briefs, and you didn't cite any case law, you just kind of said, of course it had to be. What law tells us there had to be an advisement on the setup?
Well, it goes back to the basic Parfrey decision that there has to be adequate information so that you can make an informed decision. And here's why there wasn't adequate information. Basically, if you don't tell an insured about the setup, you don't tell them about the meaning of underinsured motorist coverage. Because the way it works is underinsured motorist benefits are calculated by taking uninsured motorist benefits and subtracting an insured's bodily injury liability limits. So if an insured had $50,000 UM limits and there were bodily injury liability limits of $25,000, 50 minus 25 would leave you $25,000 underinsured motorist benefits. If the insured chose UM limits of 25, bodily injury limits of 25, 25 minus 25 would mean the insured had no underinsured motorist benefits available. So how could Mr. Shaw have made an informed decision as to the amount of UM/UIM limits to select when he didn't even know how underinsured motorist benefits were calculated because his agents did not tell him about the set-off? And so that's why the set-off, not being told about the set-off, in and of itself requires a reformation of the pickup and the Jeep policies. But let's talk about the misinformation. There's no dispute that Mr. Shaw was misinformed by Agent Gutierrez as to the meaning of per person and per accident coverage. And there's no dispute that the trial court's findings were that while Agent Basler talked to Mr. Shaw using the terms per person and per accident in discussing coverages, he did not define those terms for him. But the trial court makes the determination, well, if Mr. Shaw didn't understand the meaning of per person and per accident, he always could have asked Agent Basler to explain those terms to him. But that entirely misses the point, because he would have had no reason to ask Agent Basler to explain those terms to him, because he thought he knew based upon the misinformation. The other thing is, and so therefore, whether it's the pre- or post-amendment statute that applies here, it's an inadequate advisement under either statute. Then the third reason for the Jeep and the pickup policy needed to be reformed is Parfrey at page 914 makes clear that you have to tell the insured not only that you can raise your limits generally if you raise liability limits, but you have to tell him he can raise them to $100,000 if you raise liability limits to $100,000. I see that my time has got...
your 18 seconds are over now. It's going up. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Coffin.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Charles, you've got 4 minutes and 17 seconds. And if I can ask you at some point in your rebuttal, if you wouldn't mind addressing whether the post-amendment or pre-amendment statute applies on the cross-appeal, I would be interested in hearing your argument on that.
The post-amendment statute applies because the act that adopted that change in effect of January of 2008 said that it applies to policies issued or renewed on or after that date. And in this case, every single policy on all three vehicles was renewed on or after that date.
Thank you.
I just take exception again to this claim of there's an agent named Gutierrez. There never was an agent named Gutierrez. There was a secretary who worked in the office named Gutierrez. And to try and hold her up to what some agent might have an obligation to do is erroneous. There was testimony, and I just read Mr. Basler's testimony again in preparation for this, and he did discuss the difference between per person and per accident. You know what strikes me here is that learned people reading appellate decisions can't necessarily decide on the extent and degree to which agents should be informing their insureds under the Parfrey test. We're sitting here parsing, and what happened in this case, we're parsing case decisions to be critical of agents because they didn't say, well, gee, if you don't have uninsured motorist coverage on this Blazer and a non-relative resident passenger is injured in the Blazer, they're not going to have coverage on it. I think it becomes impossible for agents to be able to understand that. They're going to be held to the standard of lawyers and appellate judges to sit here and write policies because it's impossible. I think if you go back to the Parfrey analysis, what has to be done is a reasonable explanation of the nature and the extent of the coverage, because the insurer is obligated to read their policies and understand them as well. And I think that what's happened here is that what happened in this case is that people get asked in deposition or people get asked in trial, you know, did you read the Mullen decision? Is some agent going to read the Mullen decision? mean, claims adjusters don't read multiple, they don't have access to years and years of legal training and law books. So I think what you have to do is you have to look at what was reasonably conveyed at the time by reasonable people, given their level of opportunity and their level of instruction and what they could reasonably understand to be the requirements to be made.
Isn't that exactly what the trial judge did here?
No, because the trial judge sees on what she believed erroneously to be an error by Bass, Mr. Basler, because he didn't expressly say that if you've got a passenger in the Blazer who's a non-resident relative, that passenger's not going to be covered by UIM insurance. I don't know why the Powerfree test should be interpreted to require that level of detail. But Mr. Basler, I tell you, I read the transcript just before coming here. What he unequivocally said was that here he is, who is covered? Covers resident relatives. You don't have coverage on the Blazer, you still have coverage on the other two policies for resident relatives. And to me, that's all that Powerfree and all the Supreme Court ever intended, was that level of exchange. The other point I want to make in my last minute and 4 seconds is that there was an award of attorney fees here that was not made by the same court. The trial court in the interim had gone to the criminal bench in Denver, and Judge Stern took over the case by the time the attorney fee award came out. And that attorney fee award to me is erroneous for multiple reasons. If you recall in this case, the first claim for relief was for reformation of three policies. The plan succeeded on one and not on the other two, and there's no law that requires an award of attorney fees for reformation. The second claim was entitled UIM benefits, and again it requested the same UIM benefits of $100,000 on those three vehicles. Again, there was a 1/3 success rate. The third claim for relief was breach of contract. There was no finding of breach of contract by Shelter, so that plaintiff failed to succeed on that. The fourth claim was bad faith breach of insurance. The trial court found in favor of Shelter on that. The very last paragraph of the complaint, paragraph 29, includes a reference to 10-3-1116. So the plaintiff's success rate is less than half of the claims, yet the court awarded attorney fees for everything, when the statute only allows for the unreasonable delay or denial. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dawson. Thank you again, Mr. Kelvin. The court appreciates your briefs and your excellent oral arguments today. They were helpful to the court. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. And counsel, you're excused.